Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Unemployment is low and consumer spending is strong-ish. What could go wrong? A number of other factors, from inflation to supply chain disruptions, from the lingering pandemic to the war in Ukraine, also play a part in the current economic dynamic. And the roller coaster of the stock market has its own set of issues. Washington Post business reporter Aaron Gregg has been covering the Wall Street piece. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Can you take us through the last week of the U.S. stock market, what we were seeing, and whether that was playing out around the world?
So the stock market over the last week has kind of been pinging back and forth, but it really is just hanging just on the precipice of what we called a bear market. That's where the S&P 500 average is 20% below its most recent high. There's no particular, you know, trigger in the stock market that sets off, but people who study investor behavior say it's a very important psychological threshold where below that point, people really start to be driven by fear of losing their savings, of losing their investments. And so we're just teetering on the brink of a bear market at this point.
So it's interesting. The bear market's all about ordinary people then.
It's mostly about ordinary people because you see, those are the ones who have more to lose. An institutional investor, someone who does this for a living, they've been through it all. They've been through market crashes before. They know that markets go down, they go back up. And also, they have probably a pretty hefty salary to come home with, regardless of whether the market goes up or goes down. For us everyday civilians, that's not the case. People who are trying to invest so they can buy a house one day, so they can retire early or maybe retire at all, are going to be very, very worried when they see these prolonged stock market declines. We've seen really 5 months of sustained declines. Whenever there's a rally, it's always outweighed by another sell-off.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's one thing to have, you know, being on the precipice, but I'm wondering, is it better just to go into a bear market and get and then come out of it somehow at the other end, or to, you know, be on this kind of fence post of a market?
I guess as an everyday investor, it really depends on a couple of things. First of all, how much risk are you okay with? Are you much of a gambler, or do you want to be safe with your investments? But the second thing is your time horizon. If you want to buy a house with that money in the next couple of months or even the next year, you should really think hard about whether you want to put that money at risk, because you might lose a lot of money depending on what happens next. You might also gain a lot of money. Nobody knows what's going to happen. If you're investing for the long term, if you're okay with not touching that investment for a very long time, 4 or 5 years, maybe 10 years, you're probably fine. Markets over the long term, they tend to go up. They always have in the past. And if you're looking at a 10-year, 5-year period, it's highly likely that the period we're seeing now is a good time to buy. But the thing is that nobody knows when it's going to recover or whether we're at the bottom. So anyone who makes an investment in a market like this is taking a big risk.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And yes, we are talking about the stock market and how to view it, what it means to be here at this point in time. It all depends on where you're at in your life and how much gut you have for a risk. My guest is Aaron Gregg. He's a business reporter for The Washington Post. Are we particularly affected by a bear market in the U.S., because we are so dependent on our own investments for retirement versus much of the rest of the world, which is more into defined, I guess, portfolios like, well, not portfolios, but defined investments like pension plans?
That is an extremely good question, Anne. I think that the fact that we have pivoted as a country and as an economy away from pensions and toward 401ks over the last 30 years is something, I don't know that there has been a real policy level conversation about that. What happens if the market doesn't do well over the long term? There's just this assumption that economists and especially investors make that stocks go up in the long term. It's always been the case in the past, but for people who are trying to decide when to retire or would like to retire now as opposed to 5 years from now, that's not very helpful. So yeah, it's a very good question. I think we definitely are vulnerable to these long-term declines.
And I'm wondering how, so if we look back in time at other times when we've been on the precipice of a bear market, if we can really use those experiences to adequately, you know, suggest what's going to happen this time if we go into a bear market, because so it's happening really so rapidly in the last 25 to 30 years is when the change has taken place, right?
Yeah, I think that it's always useful to compare the current moment to past history. However, it's also worth noting that we're in an incredibly unique moment. You have the war in Ukraine, which is shooting up fuel prices all over the globe. You have inflation. You have a pandemic that is not gone yet. There could be another surge that puts us right back into lockdown. Mm-hmm. Another variant that, you know, God forbid, it might be worse than one of the previous variants. There's just so many sources of uncertainty that it's really hard to compare this economic moment to anything we've seen before.
And right, and that uncertainty beyond that is the bugaboo. I mean, that's the monster under the bed, right?
That's right. Uncertainty begets fear for the investment community. There's nothing investors hate more than uncertainty. Even if they know there's going to be a decline, they can account for that. They can sell their stock. They can short certain things. The thing that just drives investors nuts is not knowing what's going to happen next. And the reality is nobody knows what's going to happen. Yes, they're all just guessing.
When they dumped all those billions of dollars into the economy because of the pandemic, I say they, meaning the federal government, Congress, both Presidents Trump and Biden, I mean, I heard people predicting this could trigger inflation. But the Fed waited a long time, it seems like, to raise the interest rates to offset that. And it hasn't helped so far.
That's true. I think this is another unique thing about this moment we're at right now is that the Fed, I cannot think of another time when more eyes have been on the Fed, when the Federal Reserve Chairman has been almost a politically oriented figure, similar to the way Fauci was a few years ago. He's like, you know, an expert that we're all just depending on to get us out of this period. There's definitely a concern that all of those stimulus checks, all of those small business loans, the Fed's position for a long time, definitely, you know, heated the economy artificially at a time when things were not going well and contributed to the price increases that we're seeing now. There's always a trade-off between growth and keeping prices under control. If you want growth, you keep interest rates low. If you want to keep prices low, you raise them. And so that's what we're seeing is that the Fed has found itself in a position where they have to deliberately slow down the economy. It's crazy to think about it. Who wants to slow down the economy? That right. sounds terrible. But that's what they need to do to get inflation under control. And the question is, can they do it with a fine-toothed comb such that it won't crash the economy in the process?
Right, because we're also, strangely, enjoying pretty high employment and high wages as well, right?
That's correct. And it's also worth noting that retail sales are not doing bad. People are still going out to malls and to stores and buying things. The problem is that they are finding those purchases wiped out by inflation. So a lot of underlying economic indicators are pretty good, and that's it.
Okay, we just lost our guest. We will get him back because you don't want to be stuck with me. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the economy right now and how to manage it. Unemployment is low. Consumer spending seems strong, but it's being wiped out by inflation. There's a number of other factors, too. As I said, the inflation, supply chain disruptions, lingering pandemic that may resurge again, the war in Ukraine, which is wreaking havoc with our gas prices. All of that plays a part in the current economic climate. Coming up, we're going to have some other guests on that can talk to you about what this means to our pocketbooks. So if you have a question going forward, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Okay, we got Aaron Gregg back on the phone. 614-292-8513, or go on or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Erin Gregg, business reporter, for the Washington Post. You're back with us? Nope. He is not back with us. Give us a call if you have a question or comment. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Erin Gregg, are you there? Nope. We will work on that for now. Let's just take a quick break. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how to read the economy today. Unemployment is low. Consumer spending is pretty strong. But inflation is up 7% year over year. And supply chain disruptions are causing manufacturing bottlenecks. The lingering pandemic keeps everyone guessing. And the war in Ukraine is giving everyone the jitters. Chris Farrell is senior economics contributor at the nationally syndicated public radio financial news program, Marketplace. Chris Farrell, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And Ohio State professor Sherman Hanna studies personal finance, credit use, retirement adequacy, and more. Sherman Hanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I guess, you know, a lot of people, the scariest of the scared group is those who are eyeing retirement in the near future, maybe in the next 6 to 12 months. Sherman Hanna, what should they be hearing from their financial advisors at this point? Don't.
It's not the greatest time. Yeah, I mean, in the last 75 years, we've had something like 14 bear markets, depending on what stock market index you use. And so anybody like during that, each time, I think anybody who is like considering retirement just then had to think about, you know, should I wait or what, you know, and depending on your portfolio and so forth. And so certainly anybody who had not gotten carried away with how well the stock market was doing, presumably as they approached their planned retirement, would not be heavily into stocks. And then this would not be as drastic. Now, technically, I think with the S&P 500, we're not really at a bear market. It's not dropped 20% since right. its peak, but still it's sort of scary. 20% or 19.9% or whatever it is scary. And my own personal prediction would be we're going to get there because the Federal Reserve Board is going to just tighten. And a lot of the frothiness we see in the stock market, as well as other things like crypto, has to do with how much credit was available. And you could borrow a basically zero interest rate and buy real estate, buy stocks, buy crypto and so forth. And so all that pain to stop inflation, I think we're really going to see a lot more carnage in the stock market. So if you were planning to retire soon and you were still like heavily into stocks, I think you might want to consider delaying.
Well, if you're planning on retiring soon and you're heavily into stocks and you wanted to tap into that at retirement, yeah. Some people right. still have defined pension plans that they yep. can go to at the front end, right? I mean,
right.
they don't need to tap into it, but there's a lot of pieces in the air. You know, Chris Farrell, I'm wondering, is it better to be on the precipice of a bear market for months on end, or would you rather just get it over with and get through it and start looking for signs that, you know, where we're going to hit bottom?
Well, I'd like to avoid the whole thing, but I think Sherman is right. And if you give me that's my two choice, my binary choice, I'd rather be in it and okay. trying to look at how we come out of it. But I also just want to add, You know, a lot of it sort of depends what do we mean by retirement, and what is, so if you're been thinking about retirement and you're working with a financial advisor, my guess is most people have factored in some sort of trouble already in terms of, you know, I'm leaving my employer. But the other thing is more and more people, they leave their primary career behind. They retire. That's the word you use. If you're at a cocktail party, you're at a dinner party, you'll say, I'm retired. But it turns out what they have is some part-time work. They have picked up something that's going to bring in some income that they like to do to, you know, it just sort of keeps some money coming in. Mm-hmm. So if you're really thinking about retirement, I would be also adding into there, okay, how long can I delay filing for Social Security? Have I, you know, set things up in a way that I can go through this bear market? And by the way, retirement doesn't mean for most people anymore full-time leisure. It means I'm going from a full-time job to a part-time job or maybe a portfolio of activities. And so I think there's more of a cushion there if you've approached retirement that way.
This confluence of inflation, high gas prices, that's also playing a big role, Sherman Hanna, is it not, in this? It's not just the market. It's other stuff that people depend on for a certain kind of lifestyle.
Of course, yeah, and so yeah, everything, you know, and of course the causes, a little bit of debate, and you know, certainly the administration was saying, you know, transitory, and then suddenly it's not so transitory, but the all that together is certainly something, you know, because if you look at all the past bear markets, usually we don't have this confluence of high inflation and, you know, gasoline prices and so on together. And so certainly in terms of the economy, that's a problem. Now, I mean, the other thing is, I guess if as long as the labor market stays pretty good, then people who want to keep working or even switch jobs, you know, like go from a, you know, career to something different, for the moment seem to have reasonable opportunities. So, you know, in terms of that sort of transition that Chris was talking about, I think there's still hope, but eventually, you know, if we're going to really stop inflation, I mean, if we go back like to 1981, 82, it's like, it's really, really painful to stop inflation. And so if the Federal Reserve Board is really willing to inflict the pain that gets us down from, you know, very, very high inflation to, you know, 3 or 4%, then I think we are going to see problems throughout the economy and not just people's portfolios.
What should Chris, you know, when they were dumping the billions into the economy during the pandemic, a few people raised red flags and said this could cause some problems down the road. It's not solely because of that, but that's a big part of it. And I'm wondering, as they try to rein it in by way of the interest rate, who's affected by that the most? It's so low. I mean, for someone who bought a house in 1991, I don't have a lot of sympathy, but, you know, it's the larger economy at stake, right?
Yeah. So, you know, in the people that are most vulnerable right now are people who are living on low and unstable incomes. And they're the most vulnerable to higher gasoline prices, you know, need to get to work, and most vulnerable to food because a bigger part of the budget goes toward food. And then, as we all know, it's not just that home prices are up a lot. You know, you're sitting there really nice since 1991, but rents are going up a lot. And it doesn't matter where you are in the country, rents are going up. And more income is going toward paying for that shelter. So it really is a squeeze for, you know, people that we will typically define as middle class and above. And a lot of it is tightening down on your discretionary spending. So, you know, the classic example is you don't buy beef because it's gone up, you buy chicken or vice versa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can sort of trim that way. You don't go flying to you Europe for a vacation or go fly from Ohio to the West Coast, you kind of stay closer to home, although driving closer to home. So maybe all of a sudden you're thinking about a staycation. Right. You know, so people do a lot of those things to preserve their budget. But lower income people have less room to maneuver and they are hit the hardest.
Right. They're not going on vacations. They don't have the flexibility. What about inflation hurts people on fixed incomes and people on low and unstable incomes the most. Does it help anybody?
Well, it does in the sense if you're a borrower, you're paying the bank or your lender back with depreciated dollars. Okay. I mean, every dollar you pay back is, you know, you're paying them back with, in a sense, you know, a depreciated dollar. So if you're a saver, savers get hurt, right? And all savers are very, very aware of this. I don't know if you looked at your bank account lately and you have a savings account, they're not paying you 7% on your savings account or 8.5%. So a saver, their dollars are also depreciating. But if you're a borrower, hey, you know, inflationary times are not bad for you.
If you already borrowed.
That's correct.
If you're borrowed. You're just paying back, right?
The home from 1991.
Right. Oh, my goodness. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how to respond to the economic news of the day. My guests, Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor at Marketplace. That's American Public Media's nationally syndicated financial news program that you hear every day on 89.7 NPR News, and also Sherman Hanna. He's program chair of the Consumer Sciences and Human Sciences Department at Ohio State. He studies personal finance, credit use, retirement adequacy, and more. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to ask you both about this thought I had as far as, you know, we look back at previous bear markets to tell us what we, you know, to learn about how people might respond if this goes into a bear market. That's always been helpful in the past. But in the last 30 years, how we manage so much of Americans are more into the stock market now than they were before. So many fewer Americans are not in pension plans. They don't have a guarantee, an annuity type of thing where they're going to get a fixed amount of money no matter what. Sherman Hanna, how does that change the landscape in terms of what we look for and how the United States, you know, public might respond to all of this?
Well, in the long run, I still feel, you know, I mean, like if you're looking at, you know, 10, 20, 30 years until you plan to retire, this may not be a blip, but, you know, I mean, it certainly, if anybody who had like sold everything, every time there was a bear market would have been much worse off in the last 50 years, right. You know, and our last actual bear market was March of 2020. And if you blinked, you missed that the market dropped, but then it recovered and then it more than recovered and we're still above that. Way above that. So, you know, I think even though everybody, you know, a lot more people have like the 401k plans, right. And they're sort of automatically, many of them are automatically put into funds that have a lot of stocks in them. I think it's mainly a matter of being patient and maybe getting some advice or educating yourself to try to understand, you know, what's the long term. Because to me, the lesson still is, I mean, this may be a long bear market, you know, we'll see, but to me, the long-term lesson is, it's still hard to time the market because people who jump out of the market then usually wait too long to get back in and they end up doing worse than the long-term historical average. So that's one of the hard things to learn, you know, if you were, you know, in a job where 30 years ago, maybe you had a defined benefit pension and now you have to manage that, mm-hmm. You know, are people really going to be disciplined,
right,
or just jump in or jump out, you know, depending on what happens?
Yeah. Chris?
So echoing off what Sherman is saying, it's crazy that our retirement savings system, at least for the private sector with the 401k and the nonprofit sector with the 403b, it really puts too much uncertainty and decision-making on the individual to be dealing with these bear markets and bull markets and asset allocation and, you know, all these issues. And so the uncertainty, you know, people who are nearing retirement shouldn't be dealing with this degree of uncertainty. That said, one of the more positive aspects within that system that we have, and Sherman, you may know the number, but it's probably about half now of all 401k money is in target date funds. And of new money, it's actually a much higher percentage
of
new people
mean?
Who are joining. So a target date fund basically says, you're going to retire. All you have to do is say what year you're going to retire. You're going to retire at age 65. And so they make that calculation. And then it has an asset allocation, heavy in stocks when you're a younger worker. And then as time passes, the percentage of stocks shrink. Now it shrinks down to like 50% or sometimes a little bit higher. So it's not like a small bit of stocks when you hit 65. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, you're making those automatic contributions, you're dollar cost averaging, and you're rebalancing to have, you know, the portfolio that reflecting your desires. And so actually, I think a lot of people aren't going to respond to what's happening right now because they're in a target date fund. It's doing it for them. They know that. And so it's a good thing that this there are flaws to the target date fund, but the fact of the matter is it's a big improvement over what was going on before. So my guess is that if you're the typical worker and you're not playing on Robinhood or, you know, doing some stuff off on the meme stocks and having fun that way, if you're just a typical worker and you're in a 401k or a 403b, the odds are you're in a target date fund and you're not going to do anything.
I agree.
And that's a good thing. Don't you think, Sherman? That's a good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, I mean, like, you know, I could quibble if if I were giving ideal advice, I might not be precisely advising somebody for a target date fund. But as Chris said, it's like, it's better than what most people would do on their own. You know, when I hear things like people saying, well, maybe I should invest my retirement fund in crypto, or whatever, all these crazy things I think as long as most workers just rely on the default, their employers got permission from the Department of Labor to have these target date funds as default investments, so you don't have to do anything, or you'd have to do something to change the default. And then if you don't try to second guess that default, then I think most workers will end up in pretty good shape, you know.
As long as they're investing enough money into the 401k with, or the 403c,
for sure. But at least, I mean, so if you're approaching your target retirement date and your target date fund has you down to like 50% stocks, it still would be a bit bothersome to see the market go down 20% or something. But it in terms of the big picture for you, it's still not going to be as catastrophic. And then especially when you consider some of the other things like, okay, maybe, you know, if you have a household where there's more than one retirement source and maybe one person's working and the other person's not and so forth. In terms of that big picture, the stock market, the impact of the stock market drop, you know, even if it ends up being 30% or something like that, is not going to be quite as catastrophic. And then the other thing is, there's always this question of, well, like the day you retire, you know, let's just assume that you just retire completely, not the transition. What do you do the day you retire financially? And that's another part of the whole picture, because it's like, okay, do you just suddenly transform everything into cash or something and sell all your stocks? And if the stock market's down, you're really in bad shape. Or do you, maybe get a variable annuity based on this and so forth. So there's a lot of complications in terms of exactly what happens when you retire in terms of your portfolio.
Let's see. Mary in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Ann. I just wanted to suggest that if we want to reduce this inflation, one of the things economists should be researching is the impact of a country's success or failure in controlling COVID compared to its CPI rate. And I haven't really seen that.
What do you mean by CPI rate? I'm sorry.
Inflation rate.
Oh, okay.
Consumer price index.
Gotcha.
I did a little graph with eight countries whose March inflation rate was shown in the Times. South Korea, China, Japan, Britain, France, and Germany, and the United States and Canada. And I graphed their inflation rate on the x-axis compared to, on the y-axis, their cumulative COVID deaths per million as a proxy for success or failure at controlling the pandemic. There was enough of a linear look to me to say that economists ought to research this further. And with six of the countries, it was shocking. It was almost a straight line. This, of course, I don't know if I mentioned, this was, of course, before the impacts of the all the war in Ukraine and everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. But okay. I just wanted to say that's something I think I haven't heard economists pursue, and I think we ought to look at that more.
Okay. Mary, Sherman Hanna, I'll start with you. What do you think about it? Is it correlation or causative, or what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, but I mean, I guess I'm skeptical because there's so many things that are different, you know. So, you know, the United States has a lot of other unique things going on in terms of you know. So I really don't think that the COVID response is a major part of the inflation issue, personally.
Yeah, Chris Farrell, thoughts?
And I would just add, I mean, I do think where the COVID response has come in is about with the, you know, the supply chain issues that we've, you know, all become. I mean, 18 months ago, people didn't talk about supply chains, right? That was academics like Sherman talked about supply chains, but you know, the typical person, now we're all aware of supply chains. And it's because of COVID, it's because the factories can't be working, people can't be heading to work. So, I mean, I do think that there's been a lot of look at the impact of the pandemic and both its impact on inflation in terms of fiscal stimulus to support the economy, and that's had an inflationary impact. And that fiscal stimulus was driven by COVID, I mean, just, you know, the pandemic. And then also the supply chain issue, which is now worsened, as you mentioned, with Ukraine and also China's lockdown. But again, that's COVID related. So I think inflation and COVID have been very tied together, but it's a slightly different twist than measuring it by success or less success measured by death.
Mary, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. Anybody else? Questions, comments? 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We are talking about the economy and how we respond to all that's going on out there. My guests, Chris Farrell, he's senior economics contributor at Marketplace. That's American Public Media's nationally syndicated financial news program. You hear it here on 89.7 NPR News. And also Sherman Hanna, program chair of Consumer Sciences in the Human Sciences Department at Ohio State. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how to respond to the economic news of the day. Still with us, Chris Farrell, a senior economics contributor at the nationally syndicated public radio financial news program, Marketplace, and Ohio State professor Sherman Hanna, who studies personal finance, credit use, retirement adequacy, and more. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm wondering about the price of gas, because for so long, the United States has felt like it's, I don't understand it, but it looked, always has looked artificially low to me when you compare it to the rest of the developed world and developing world. Any thoughts, Sherman Hanna, about what it could mean if it doesn't go down again and maybe keeps going up, regardless of what's happening in Ukraine?
Right. Well, I think that, you know, a lot of it has to do with taxes and so forth, if we make comparisons to like some countries in Europe and so forth. But I don't know whether it'll stay down permanently. You know, certainly there's a capacity to do more in for U.S. production, but obviously people would have to really readjust their driving and so forth if it stayed up. So I don't know. I mean, that's going to be a big issue. You know, it's one thing to say I can switch from steak to
chicken.
Hamburger or
mm-hmm.
something like chicken if the food price goes up, but people who rely on their vehicles, there's not a whole lot they can do. And so that's, I think that's certainly the most painful part of the inflation for many households now.
Yeah, Chris?
And what I would add is that, at least at this point in time, high price of gas, it's over $4, depending on where you are. California, it's over $6. And, you know, we complain about it because you fill up fairly regularly and you see that bill. But Memorial Day is the start of the holiday season, right? The summer driving season. And AAA just came out with their report, and they're predicting that driving is going to be up over 8%, and that air travel is going to be up over a quarter. And so we're complaining about it, but I'm not seeing a huge impact on actually the way people are behaving, at least not yet. There may come a time when if prices continue to go higher. But when it comes to energy, and energy is really important, but energy is a global market. And, you know, you can see what the Biden administration is trying to do, which is trying to bring down the price of oil. Those efforts are going to continue. But the price of gasoline we're paying right now is really being driven by what's happening with Ukraine. And so far, at least at this point in time, I don't see a whole big impact on people's behavior yet at $4 plus gas. A lot of behavior on people not liking it for understandable reasons, because it cuts into your budget right away, but not so much a change in behavior.
I read an interest. Go ahead, Sherman.
Yeah, I think one thing in terms of a lot of people, I mean, there's some people who won't have any choice because their finances won't allow them to keep filling up the tanks. But American households are actually pretty flush. Many of them are flush right now, because in 2021 we had the stimulus payments and the enhanced child tax credit, and also people who are getting their federal income tax refund if they had children and qualified for the enhanced child tax credit. So people's bank accounts, especially if they benefited from the stimulus payments and or the enhanced child tax credit, are relatively good, you know. So, and then there's also the pent up demand for, I want to travel. I want to get out of here. And so I think we'll see some of that for a while. But obviously, you know, if you're a trucker or something like that, or you have a long commute and you're going to go through your savings account and your extra checking account pretty fast. And pretty soon it's really going to be painful.
And on that positive note, let's switch to Jim in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Like he was saying, people are flush right now. Americans have done well, and they just start to get ahead of the game a little bit, and then something like this comes in and takes it away or begins to take it away. But inflation hurts the poor more than anybody. The other thing is, if you want to send a signal to the markets – into the world about doing something with inflation, get us back to being on the road to energy independence. Again, that will send a major signal and increase supply. Sustainable energy is in the future.
Okay.
The technology and the free markets to bring it on board, it's going to happen. But you can't take a a meat cleaver to it, like what's happening right now, and trying to force it. It's going to happen. It's going to come. We're going to have it. But you're going to wreck a lot of things, especially the economy, by doing what they're doing right now.
Okay. It's
absolutely apprehensible.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Chris?
Or just wait a little bit, and I'm really glad that he raised the point. I mean, I do think energy is critical, and energy ripples throughout our whole system. When we're thinking about the price of oil, the shift here really is that the Saudis have not opened the spigots the way that they have historically under the circumstances. So I don't think it has much to do with domestic production. It has a lot. There's other reasons why domestic production is not growing much. Take a look at the dividend payments. Take a look at some of the issues that they've gone through. It has a lot more to do with the Saudis, and that is where the administration and other people are doing what negotiating they need to be doing. But I also think that we're in one of those times where Jim was saying is absolutely, energy is really important. We have not made the transition. That doesn't mean that, and in fact, I would during this period of time accelerate the investments that are going into the transition, at the same time recognizing that we are still on traditional fossil fuels dependent. I think a lot of it has to do with foreign affairs and not domestic affairs.
It's different, though. I mean, I remember back in the 70s when I just got my license and OPEC was formed and, Dad took the credit card out of the car and we had to pay for our own gas. And but I'm thinking that you couldn't get gas. There were lines to get gas. Why is that? I don't know. I know you guys aren't necessarily energy experts, but why is it just the price of gas that's going up, but there's not necessarily a shortage? Is there, Sherman Hanna?
Well, we have a free market that, I think basically, although there's been a little bit of talk in a few places in the administration about, trying to limit prices and stuff. And that's the way we would get gas lines and rationing and so forth. But as long as we don't go there, okay. Then I think, because, basically, love him or hate him, Ronald Reagan basically said, did away with a lot of the restrictions and we didn't have gas lines, we didn't have quotas and, rationing and so forth. And we've pretty much stuck with that approach since then.
We're also a lot more energy efficient compared to back in the the initial OPEC area. And if you can kind of look at these charts, and no one can see me on the radio, but I'm drawing a chart that's going down. And if you look about how much more energy efficient we have become since those early OPEC, the original OPEC embargo, we're a much more efficient economy.
Well, and I think I was going to bring up earlier that I read an interesting analysis of that very thing, and that coupled with inflation, what we're paying for gas per gallon now isn't costing us that much more now than it did back in the 70s because of efficiencies. We get more bang for our gallon of gas, although it seems like it's burning much faster in the car now that I'm paying $4.50.
We live in a world where everything is relative yes. as opposed to absolute.
Right.
And so we're dealing with relative price increases and they hurt.
Right. Yeah. That's when I paid 25 cents a gallon for gasoline and made $1.25 an hour.
Exactly. There was a piece in The Washington Post that said that veteran investors are searching for signs that the bottom is approaching. And I'm wondering, for us not unveteran investors, what is the bottom? What do they look for when it comes to the bottom? Chris Farrell?
So I just have to say this, let veteran investors do that for the individual. One of the things that is good about a 401k or a 403b is your money goes in monthly and it's called dollar cost averaging. And essentially you're going to benefit from what the veteran investors are doing as they try and figure out, where is bottom. So they'll be looking at things like, investor sentiment, changes in investor sentiment, that we look particularly of senior management, right? So is senior management buying more of their stock? And that's a classic sign, or it's, are companies buying back more of their stock? That's something people are looking at. But they're really, if you're an equity investor, what you're really watching is the interest rate environment. And you're essentially trying to figure out, have interest rates peak? Are interest rates going to peak at 3%? Are they going to peak at 4%? Big implications for how you think about the relative value between the stock and the bond market. And so those are the kinds of, and they'll look at things like the yield curve. So the 2-year treasury versus the 10-year treasury. If the 2-year treasury is above, you know, the 10-year treasury, that means people are really scared. If vice versa, means people are getting more optimistic, right, about the future. So it's all delving into signs of optimism about the future.
And the other thing I just throw in there is that if you're like a 30-year-old worker who has money going into a 401k or 403b or something like that, if we have a really bad bear market, it's like stocks are on sale. You know, so I had, you know, if you had contributions to your retirement account, it's a little different back then, but like around, you know, 1970s and so forth, early 1980s, it's like, okay, I was buying stocks, you know, when they were cheap. And anytime in the last couple of years, it's been like you're paying very high. So, you know, it's like the grocery store cut prices 50% if we have a 50% drop. But for a worker who's still putting a lot of money into the retirement accounts, that's a good thing.
Should we be worried? I'm thinking about, you know, when we look at things like Walmart, the biggest retailer in the world, Target, another close right up there, those kind of things. We depend so much on these individual entities. And I'm also thinking about the formula, the baby formula issue. There's only a few makers of baby formula. We had other issues. The chip makers were not in the United States. There's only a few chip makers out there. We depend more and more in this world on just a few entities to provide things we really need, Chris Farrell. And I'm wondering about just our economy writ large. They're not actually monopolies, but...
No, but if you think about the past 40 years, what has been the major trend among big companies has been consolidation.
Right.
And, you know, and you've seen it in the airline industry, you've seen the trucking industry, you see it pretty much in industry after industry. And one of the things coming out of the pandemic is that the big got even bigger, because they had the resources and the digital technology in order to navigate that very difficult period of time. And so what I think that with the baby formula, which may be an extreme case, but the baby formula issues has really highlighted how vulnerable our economy is to this consolidation. And that ties into a rethinking. It's wrong to say that there's that globalization is dying or globalization is over, but it is. We're going, you know, maybe it's called globalization 3.0, where globalization was, you had these very long supply chains, you know, between the US and Asia, particularly China. And now you're thinking, well, I need a factory here in the US, I need a factory in Europe, I need a factory in Asia. And so a rethinking of it. So consolidation, we don't have simple solutions to this, but I think it is widely recognized that many industries have consolidated too much.
Well, we're out of time. I really appreciate your time today. Sherman Hanna, Program Chair of Consumer Sciences in the Human Sciences Department at OSU, studies personal finance, credit use, retirement, adequacy, and more. Thanks for sharing your wisdom today, Sherman. I appreciate it. And Chris Farrell, Senior Economics Contributor at Marketplace, American Public Media's nationally syndicated financial news program. Chris, as always, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's it for now. So thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.